Ellen, you distinguish between death and dying. What's the difference between these two?
Well, I think it's, from my point of view, it's fairly simple. Death is what we refer to when you're dead, and everything after that, including funerals, cemeteries, bereavement, memorialization, that kind of thing. Dying, on the other hand, is that period of life before death, where you're expecting to die, when you're expecting to become dead, and that could be in a few hours. It could be within 30 minutes if you're on a stricken plane, for example, that you know is going down, or it could be months, and sometimes it's even years.
And my sense is that you believe that we as a culture haven't really come to terms with the whole experience of dying.
I think that is increasingly the case. It's really been a 20th century phenomena, really, this whole problem of not coming to grips with the fact that you will die. It was, even in our culture, much more, what would you say, people were more comfortable with the idea of death and dying a century ago than they are today. And progressively, I think partly because most industrial cultures are kind of in love with medical rescue, that the idea of dying is a distasteful idea that needs to be pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. So I think our culture has increasingly de-skilled itself and has moved away from kind of a psychological comfort, if you like, with the idea of mortality.
What do you mean our culture has de-skilled itself when it comes to dying?
Well, I think a lot of people, if you were given, you know, 6 months to live, a lot of people's minds would go blank. Some would get highly anxious, particularly those in midlife. And then they would wonder what they should be doing. I mean, some people might say, well, I'll throw a party or I'll have a trip around the world. The research suggests that most people don't do any of those things, that they continue to work and do the things that they normally do until such time as their health declines in a radical way. I think by and large, most people have given little thought to the idea that they will die and have not prepared themselves for it very well. And we could be talking about things like wills and financial preparations on the one hand. And on the other hand, we can talk about existential and spiritual preparation, if you like. The idea that you ask yourself on a fairly regular basis, what values and relationships are important to me, fundamentally important to me? If I was to die next weekend, would I be happy with the last 12 months of my life? Those kinds of questions people are increasingly asking themselves, but still I think that the vast majority of people put these questions away from their minds. And it takes a crisis like a life-limiting illness or something like that to really push that to the forefront.
Do you think people in previous historical eras have dealt with those questions better, especially the existential spiritual questions?
I think they have, and I think the anthropological evidence is pretty strong that they have. The first reason is that religion was much stronger in the past and it permeated almost every aspect of life outside, particularly outside the city. Bear in mind that for most of history, the bulk of people lived in rural areas. So that's the first thing. And I think the second thing is that through most of human history, life expectancy was very short. We are talking about an average life expectancy of somewhere in the mid-20s to the mid-30s. So by the time you reach 18 or 19 years of age, you've seen a lot of people die, your brothers and sisters and your mother and your father. So death and dying is something that you can't avoid and that you confront very early in life. And therefore, you tend to think much more about, well, I could be next. So what are the things that I want to do? These kinds of questions are uppermost, I think, in most people's lives through most of human history in most societies.
Well, you have studied the history of dying going way back. I mean, going back to the Stone Ages, tens of thousands of years ago. What do we know about how people thought about dying back then?
Well, if you talk about the bulk of human history is really the history of hunter-gatherer societies, you know, people who basically hunt for a living. They're not farmers. They do a bit of scavenging and a bit of berry picking and opportunistic scavenging. But by and large, most of human history is like that. And for that period of time, the cause of death is primarily trauma. So that's snake bite or falling off a cliff or poisoning or childbirth. They're the common forms of death. And what characterizes that pattern, if you like, of death and dying is that it's very short. The period between when you realize you're going to die and when you actually die is a matter of minutes or hours. At best, it might be a day or two. And what that's done historically is make many societies think about dying as not something that happens to the body. Death is something that happens to the body. But dying as the annihilation of your identity. So the dying occurs post-death in most hunter-gatherer societies. If you look at their myths and legends across a whole range of human societies, you'll see that dying was something that occurred when you appeared in the supernatural world. And in Fiji, for example, if you never married, there was a spinster god or a spinster monster, if you like, that would try to kill you on your journey towards the heaven, if you like, or the perfect world. Most people would not expect to make it into the next world. Their journey would be 100 days long or 200 days long, depending on the traditions. And in that journey, you would encounter many hazards and challenges, and you would be killed along the way. So your dying would occur post-death. Now,
why would that not be considered just the afterlife, something that happens after death? Why would that all be considered part of the dying process?
In historical religions like Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism or any of those kinds of recent historical religions, you don't normally think of yourself dying in the afterlife. You can't really be killed in the afterlife.
Right.
It's only the hunter-gatherers who seem to think that the real dying, the annihilation of your personality, the cessation of your existence occurs after your body has been destroyed. Now, that's a very peculiar take if you compare it with modern ways of thinking about dying. When I use the word modern, I mean since the last ice age, the last 12,000 years. In the last 12,000 years, we've started to become farmers and horticulturalists and gardeners. And what happens there is that instead of moving away from the soiled area that we create by standing in one place, by eating and drinking and sleeping, we actually start to live on top of our own soil, in addition which we start to live with animals. And so we start to catch the diseases of animals, the cows, you know, the leprosy, the tuberculosis, the chickens, the chicken pox, all of those kinds of things. And we start to get infectious diseases. And then we really do start to see people ailing and dying over a period of a week, several weeks. And then we start to see a community turn towards that sick person and ministrate in a way we've never seen before. So at that time, we start to see the first evidence of priests and doctors, shamans, people like that, who come to attend at the side of the dying person. Now, as we move towards urbanization, which really picks up in the last few hundred years, we see a professionalization of those fairly informal roles. So we see the doctor really become a professional person, and the funerals are taken away from community, and we get the rise of the funeral director, the funeral professional. We see the rise of cemetery management. We see the rise of lawyers. We see the rise of nurses and so forth. So what you get is a move away from a kind of community support of dying to professional support of dying, which is very strong in urban areas.
And it sounds like also dying becomes a more private affair as well. I mean, it becomes less of an entire community event.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens. It does get more privatized. It does become more individualized and idiosyncratic. And we see that increasingly the case now. But in this period, and since World War II, what we've seen is that dying has slowly given way to the idea that we can either make it as short as possible or it's unnecessary. So we get this idea, a belief in medical rescue, where the doctor can always do something for you. And if they're not, we can find somebody else who can. There's got to be some kind of cure, some kind of new protocol that you can involve yourself in. And so it's very, I think, uncommon these days to find people say, actually, I'm dying of cancer. And most people are saying, I'm living with cancer.
Right.
And I hope to be a survivor. And that's great. I mean, well, that's good too.
People don't really want to say they're dying, right? I mean, that's kind of a, I mean, that's the last thing we want because it's a stigma, you know, among other things.
Yes, it is a stigma, and it's a bit of a social faux pas, which is probably the same thing in some ways. But if you do, if you look at the studies of nursing home residents, older people in nursing homes, they're quite keen to talk about themselves as dying people. They're quite happy to talk about death and dying. And then if you look at the American studies and the British studies, they come up with the same results. Older people are very open about this. And one of the interesting things about that is that the degree to which they're successful in discussing this topic depends on the management culture of the nursing home or the care home. So if the care home thinks this is bad taste, and they discourage residents from talking about it, but if the care home is open and facilitative, you find people talking about making, you know, getting their advance directives in place, making wills, and actually giving things away to fellow residents and family because they know that they're dying and they're happy to talk about the afterlife, reunion, or the fact that there's nothing after death. And you will find that that generation of people quite like to talk about death and dying. Now, if I go to a social occasion, a party, and I tell people what I do for a living, I'm inundated by people who like to talk about death and dying. So, you know, you've got to say to yourself, do people really not want to talk about death and dying? And I don't think that's entirely true. I think that people don't always like to talk about death and dying to everyone. But usually, if the circumstances are encouraging and supportive, a lot of people are very keen to talk about death and dying, and they've got lots of questions which they like to discuss with each other as well.
Yeah. I want to go back to the Stone Age for a moment. What's the evidence for how we know these things about how people thought about dying back more than 10,000 years ago?
Yeah. Okay. The evidence is from three sources. The first one is we have archaeological evidence of burial sites, grave goods. And there's been an extensive study of grave goods all around the world. And although there's some debate about the exact content of some graves, for example, some of the contents may be a result of geological intrusion over time. Nevertheless, many of the grave sites suggest a very active belief in the afterlife. And many of the grave goods also indicate not just goods that represent the grief of survivors, but also that they're giving gifts to the dead to actually use. For example, spears.
you need a spear in the afterlife.
Why would you need a spear in the afterlife? Now, this suggests a set of beliefs. Now, so we'll come back to this set of beliefs business. The second source of archaeological evidence that we have is cave drawings. And again, there's been extensive studies of cave drawings and a great debate about what these drawings mean. But nevertheless, of many of the different theories that you could select from, there are theories that suggest that the journeys into caves and the paintings put there represent beliefs about a journey post-death, that there is a communing, indeed, a communing with the dead and supernatural beings in these kinds of places.
Because a lot of these cave paintings are not realistic. I mean, they're kind of dreamlike or have sort of mythological figures, right?
That's right. That's usually been the interpretation, unless you're von Daniken and you think they're aliens from outer space. But most of the time, the conventional view is that these are religious figures. These are spiritual figures of some sort or another. And the third source of evidence comes from studies of modern hunter-gatherer societies. These are contemporary societies, and some of that ethnographic evidence goes back a few hundred years old as well. But if we compare the beliefs and the behaviours of contemporary hunter-gatherers with ancient hunter-gatherers, we can also draw similarities. So we have three sources. All those sources have problems. Don't misunderstand me here. All three have problems, but it's got to be said that most evidence has problems. But these, if you intersect these three sources of evidence, we get a fairly general but sound view that hunter-gatherers had a very, in general, hunter-gatherer economies and the peoples of those economies had a fairly elaborate view about dying as a post-death journey, which ended in the real death 50, 100, 300 days after the destruction of their body.
So what
fairly cross-cultural.
What would people need to do in this post-death dying process? This journey where it sounds like they're on some sort of quest.
Yeah. Well, again, you've got to look at this kind of thing society for society. The Fijians have a different view of this to the Kalahari Bushmen, for example. They would have a different set of legends, different gods to dodge, different evils to worry about, different consequences of moral behavior whilst alive. So, for example, in Fiji, as I mentioned earlier, it is incumbent upon people to marry. So if you don't marry for any reason, there are consequences. And when you grow up, you learn about these legends. You learn about the journey after death. In much the same way as that you would learn these things in Sunday school in a kind of normal Christian type family. You're prepared from a very young age to understand that life is not just the destruction of the body, that there are transformations that happen. If you talk to the Australian Aborigines, they'll point to a tree and say, you know, that was my uncle. That snake there was, you know, my great-great-grandfather. You know, so transformation, the idea of transformation, that of moving through different forms, and that life is a cycle and a transformative cycle at that, is a widespread belief in hunter-gatherer cultures. And so you'd need to look from society to society about which specific challenges members expect to face post-death.
Now, is the expectation then that if you know this history, I mean, sort of what's supposed to happen in this post-death journey, yeah, that you're supposed to live differently before you die?
Yes. I mean, these are essentially moral narratives. I mean, most visions of the afterlife aren't just descriptions. They're moral descriptions. They are meant to teach as much as create expectations. So, if you're a Christian, you don't just read the story about heaven and hell. If you're a Catholic, if you don't read stories about heaven, hell, and purgatory in a kind of neutral fashion, it's not, you don't get randomly allocated to these places. You realize that if you want to avoid the bad places, you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't, you know, take somebody else's wife, you shouldn't murder people, you know, basic kinds of things. And every society has some kind of moral compass, more or less, obviously not as highly prescriptive and legislative, if you like, as historical religions. The hunter-gatherers have a much simpler idea of principles. But nevertheless, the universe has good and evil in it, and there are things that you can do in life to prepare yourself for the journey ahead.
Now, it would be tempting to say that these old attitudes about dying were primitive in some way, you know, sort of full of superstition. And today we're much more sophisticated. We know a lot about the science of dying. Do you see it that way?
No, I don't see it that way. I'm not entirely sure that, I mean, I don't like the term superstition. I wouldn't say that the hunter-gatherer societies were superstitious. What characterizes a lot of hunter-gatherer societies is a belief that life permeates everything. So many hunter-gatherer societies are animists, and they believe there's life in the rock and the tree and the sky and the sun and the moon and the sea and those kinds of things. There is a purpose in the patterns in the ground and the way plants grow and the colors they have. Now, over time, and that's a very sophisticated view, I will remind you, over time, we have withdrawn from that kind of view of the universe, and we've largely invested all our mystical sense into monotheism or polytheism, a belief in one god or several, who are usually invisible, what some anthropologists used to refer to as the Sky Father. The idea that God is invisible, that the afterlife is invisible, that the trick is to discern meaning and to please a particular god. Now, that you know, if you want to say which one is simple, maybe that one is the more simple. Hmm. And it's been so simple that it's actually taken churches and temples a lot of effort to create interpretations, dogma, if you like, in each of those churches to interpret not only your own behavior, but what God's intentions are. Whilst in hunter-gatherer societies, reading intention is a little simpler, even if the world itself is populated in a far more complex way. So it's horses for courses. I mean, the complexity is there in hunter-gatherer society, and it's there in our own religions, but it's in a different order, if you like.
Well, one thing that's striking about this whole history that you've been talking about is there was an assumption that the afterlife was a given. I mean, immortality existed regardless of what culture you're talking about.
Yes.
I mean, this modern idea that as we've come to live in more secular societies, that maybe everything just ends at the point of biological death. I mean, that's actually a radically new idea.
Yeah. Look, I don't think in modern society, I don't believe I have to depart from this. I don't believe the materialist view that in modern society we've moved away from religion. Yes, we have moved away from religion, but the overwhelming majority of people have a belief in God or have spiritual beliefs that entail the afterlife, have a kind of moral cosmology that is linked to some private view of destiny and divinity. And you look at any of the major surveys in the United States and Britain, you'll find high numbers of people, even the majority of people in some areas, have a belief in God and the afterlife. The idea that in the modern world we don't believe in God or the afterlife anymore is overrated and oversold. It's simply not true.
Even in a country like the UK, where, you know, it's far less religious, at least I've been told, than the United States.
Well, it depends on what criteria you're using. If you're talking about church attendance, yes. But church attendance is no necessary measure of spiritual beliefs. It's no necessary measure of belief in God, for example, or a belief in the afterlife. And in fact, it's that dimension, the spiritual dimension and the theological dimension, if you like, which I think has not taken the beating as much as church attendance. Church attendance and prayer and getting involved in religious rituals, these things have taken a bit of a beating since World War II. But even then, there's debate in academic circles about whether or not that's gotten worse or it's returning to its traditional levels. Some people argue that church attendance in Britain, for example, for the last 200 years, it was around the kind of 17 to 20% and leapt up after World War II to over 50%. And what we're seeing is a return to those traditionally lower levels of church attendance. But church attendance, seeing a priest, getting involved in the sacraments, all of these kinds of things, I still tell you, doesn't mean that not being involved in those things doesn't mean that you don't believe in God or that you don't believe in a divine purpose in the universe. And I would say that that is alive and well in industrial societies.
Hmm. Well, I mean, this raises a fascinating philosophical question. If you don't believe in immortality, I mean, if you don't believe there's some sort of afterlife,
yep.
Does that change the whole project of how people or even how societies construct meaningful lives?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, I think it is a human project that you construct a meaning for the life that you live. That you fail to do so or are unable to do so is a life-threatening situation. I mean, that for a lot of people, that's the reason they live. And if you can't find a purpose, you're in trouble. And that is the case in all cultures. So it doesn't really matter if you don't believe in God. It's important that you believe in something greater than yourself, and that may well be human welfare. You know, it may be enough for you to say, the purpose of my life, even if it, you know, fizzles out at the age of 67 and I just turn to fertilizer for the plants and the animals, if that's all life is for you, it's enough to feel that you've made a contribution to a better world for other human beings. For many people, that's the case. Or for your family, that you're able to generate wonderful children and you've been able to support them for the next generation. There are many meanings which are important to make a life worthwhile. And religion, although it's been the number one top of the pops throughout human history in all societies, it's not the only one. And increasingly there is that group of people for whom belief in the divine is not an important part of their existential meaning.
Now, in recent years, there's been a lot of talk and some debate as well about a good death. Do you think there is such a thing as a good death?
No, I'm not that keen on the idea of good death when you move away from the anthropological use of that phrase. I think it's important to try to, you know, I mean, I do this in my own life, try to live healthy, try to stay fit, tackle what you can. But occasionally your genes or your environmental exposure means that you end up with a disease where you might die earlier. And you know the odds. Sometimes when you get that illness, you can share that idea that you will die with some people, and other people you've got to give them the line that you're fighting it. You know, it's people speak to different audiences. Everyone does that. But I think that most people who are dying do, as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was one of the first to make this observation, most people who are dying understand that they're dying, and it doesn't mean they're going to be dying next week, although it could be. It may mean that they know that in the end this will defeat them in a year or two. Now, that group of people will try to live that last year, that last month, that last day, that last few hours, as best as they can with medical and with social support. And that, and if they succeed, so that they're not dying in agony, for example, or they're not dying in a flat panic, that's pretty good. Now, I don't know whether you call that a good death, but that's pretty good. When you realize that historically, a lot of people did die in agony, that it was very difficult to provide medical support with major cancers or major neurological diseases. Medicine has made a huge difference to the way in which people can die today. It's made a major difference to the quality of life. And you only need to visit a hospice or a palliative care service for a couple of hours to realize what huge strides we've made in making people comfortable at the end of life.
Well, I think in sort of modern terms, a good death usually refers to a couple of things. One is that you don't end up getting needless and, in the end, kind of harmful prolonged medical care. I mean, it doesn't drag out so that you're just kind of a shell of the person you used to be and sort of having these miserable last few days or weeks or even years. And then the other piece of it is to accept that you're going to die, to acknowledge it rather than sort of fighting it to the very end. I mean, that's usually what is considered sort of a piece of the good death, and which also means coming to terms with it and, you know, perhaps repairing relationships that had gone astray.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the point you're making, but I would just add one thing. If you want to use the good death as an audience label, so you're looking at somebody who is living with a life-limiting illness and you want to say, did that person have a good death or not? You might say that the first category, the person who has all the medical treatments and resists right to the end, has a bad death. And the person who at some earlier stage finds acceptance and goes into a palliative care program, they might have a good death. But if you use good death as a self-description, then the person who fights all the way to the grave may well be having a good death because that's the way they like to play it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's horses. Uh-huh. Again, it's horses for courses. You know, I, there's a limit to how prescriptive you can be. Obviously, I think if you ask me, I think at some point I would agree with you that an acceptance of death and a withdrawal from aggressive treatment regimes may be preferable, may be better on you physically, as well as psychologically, as well as socially. However, some people like to go kicking and screaming. And some people have lived their life that way. And if that's the way they want to go out, for them, that's a good death.
Yeah. Now, I know you have spent a lot of time with people who are dying. You've seen this up close. Is it your sense that the people who really do confront their mortality, do they tend to have transformative experiences emotionally or spiritually in their final days or weeks or months?
Yes. The transformative experience is a complex area. I've just written a book called The Inner Life of the Dying Person, and I discuss that very issue in this book. The thing about transformative experiences is, yes, okay, if you're a person who says, look, I've got a fatal disease, I'm going to try to take the treatments, I'm going to try to live as well as I can, but I understand that in a year or in 6 months' time, I'm going to die. That kind of acceptance does have a way of making, of freshening up, if you like, people's perception of relationships around them. They get a new appreciation for the blue sky, the friendships that they have, the time they spend with their children and so forth. There is no doubt that that kind of exception, that kind of circumstance, if you like, re-energizes people's lives and their emotions and their perceptions.
There's a sense that each day is very meaningful in a way that those of us not facing this sort of don't even think about.
It's not only more meaningful, but it looks different, Stephen. It looks different. If you talk to some of these people, they will tell you that the sunshine or the roses outside their bedroom window never look so good. Their experiences are actually changed. It isn't just their belief system. It's the experience itself. The idea that you will die soon changes the way in which you receive the world. And that's the transformative aspect of it. Also, some people decide to change their behavior. They relate differently to people. They try to repair relationships. They try to put into relationships. Time is precious. So it does alter the way many people experience those last few weeks and months. But furthermore, there's a limit to that as well, because some people have felt that the knowledge that they will die hasn't been particularly transformative, but odd things have happened. They've had mystical experiences. They've had strange lights in their room. They've had they've experienced communications, if you like, from people who've died before them. I mean, you look at the deathbed vision literature and you'll see quite a bit of this. I think the median time that people get visits is 3 days before they die. And in
you're not just talking about what are called near-death experiences. I mean, people.
I'm talking about deathbed visions. Huh. So these people are fully conscious. They may be lying in bed, and they get visit from a dead child or a dead parent or an old dead friend. They're called deathbed visions.
And these are common?
Well, in the Eastern European and Asian studies we have suggests the prevalence is 1 in 3.
Wow.
The British studies we have suggest 1 in 10. And that's because I think largely we use a lot more opiates, and also the designs of the study are quite different. But I don't want to get sidetracked into that. What I want to say about this is that, because they're not the only things that happen to people during this period, but some of the transformative experiences, and you use the phrase transformative experiences, some of these things come unbidden, which is to say you're not seeking them. You know, you work every day in radio or whatever it is you do, and you come home at night, and your life is pretty banal. You don't expect anything strange. You certainly don't expect to see your dead father coming to see you in the evening, right? You're not that kind of guy. I'm not that kind of guy. So, but it's interesting that when you sit down with people who are living with a life-limiting illness, at some point you will often hear these kinds of strange stories. They won't just say, oh, look, the roses outside my window look fantastic. With trust, some will disclose unusual things that they will even think are unusual. And you could say, well, maybe these are hallucinations. Well, maybe they are. But what the issue is that they are transformative. They're thought-provoking. They make you rethink what you think reality is. They make you rethink what you think you know about dying.
Do more people who have religious or spiritual beliefs tend to have these kinds of deathbed visions?
No, they don't. We haven't seen any correlation. And we've done the multivariate analysis on this. There's no relationship between age, sex, religious beliefs, diagnosis, any of those things, and the incidence of these deathbed visions. It's a bit like near-death experiences. Near-death experiences don't seem to have any sociodemographic variable which will predict them. They seem to occur to everyone.
I want to come to near-death experiences in a moment, but just to follow up on the deathbed vision. So how do you explain these deathbed visions? I mean, you're a scientist. What do you make of them?
Well, no, I'd like to say I'm a scholar rather than a scientist. It's a little bit different. You know, when you say to people, oh, I'm a scientist, you know, people have this expectation that, you know, you don't believe anything outside a randomized controlled trial. Well, that's not the kind of Joe I am. I'm more considered. My work is multidisciplinary. It's not New Age or any of those kinds of things. I do conventional academic research. I am interested in empirical studies, but I realize there's a limit to empirical studies, that there's quite a bit of theoretical interpretation involved in all great scholarship, but it has to be disciplined thinking. So, I mean, what you make of these kinds of things is quite difficult, because one of the problems these days, working in the 20th century and the 21st century, is that anything mystical causes in academic circles, in particular academic circles, causes a great freak out. You've got to understand that universities are the child of post-Renaissance in some ways. Many universities are trying to, and have for hundreds of years, split themselves from the church, from religion, and are basically saying, well, reason, that's our religion. Reason is our religion. And in the middle to the late 20th century, that they've taken that one step further and they've said, well, actually, not just reason, but empirical testing. What I can't measure or see doesn't exist. Now, that's a pretty radical philosophical step. If you had a couple of philosophers here in the radio room today, they would say, well, that really is quite a radical view, because philosophically it represents only one type of view of the world. There is a lot we can't see and can't explain. Otherwise, we can all go home this afternoon. We've wrapped it up. And there, you know, there's a lot of debate on this kind of thing. So clearly, there's a whole bunch of medicos and psychologists and who will tell you that, you know, near-death experiences are hallucinations.
Right. I mean, there's a whole literature to explain near-death experiences. I mean, particularly the person who is, let's say, had a heart attack, the brain starts to shut down, the oxygen leaves the brain. There are explanations that, you know, that kind of thing can induce that experience of seeing the white light in the tunnel. There's a whole kind of physiological explanation of near-death experiences.
Yeah, it's not really an explanation, Steve. It's a whole series of theories, untested, most of it. We've got plenty of studies of people during oxygen deprivation, and they don't go down dark tunnels and see bright beings of light. So oxygen doesn't seem to have that kind of effect. Oxygen deprivation doesn't seem to have that kind of effect on people. The other thing is that if you take things like out-of-body experiences, tunnel sensation, meetings with supernatural beings, including the white light, all of that kind of thing has occurred to people without losing consciousness. So if you just take the key characteristics of the so-called near-death experience, they occur to people who've been conscious as well as unconscious. It's just that in medicine, the big brouhaha is that they've discovered these kinds of characteristics in people who recover from, say, cardiac arrest and whatnot. So the obvious explanation, if you ask a medico, is that these are probably hallucinations. But actually, they don't conform to a lot of what we understand about hallucinations. For one weird thing, everyone's having the same hallucination, which is not a characteristic of hallucinations, because hallucinations, one of the first characteristics of hallucinations is their diversity. So if you pop a pill and I pop the same pill and you have a hallucination, it would be remarkable if it was the same one as I had. But all of these people are having kind of out-of-body experiences. They are meeting a bright being of light. Many of them are reviewing their lives. Some are seeing supernatural vistas. And the other thing is that if tunnel sensation or life review was due to physiological processes, then you would expect a New York businessman and a New Guinean tribesman to have exactly the same experiences. But in fact, some of these characteristics are not even cross-cultural. So you'll never get that. We haven't found a case of a hunter-gatherer who's had a life review, because their psychology doesn't, their particular psychology doesn't worship individual biography the way that individualism has taken root in capitalist societies, where the individual and the biography and the career is all about the individual. So a life review makes sense for somebody like that. But in hunter-gatherer societies, you can't ask an Australian Aboriginal person 100 years ago to review their lives, because that wouldn't make any sense. Their lives don't make any sense outside their own community.
So can you explain this a little bit? So how would a near-death experience for that New Yorker differ from the near-death experience of the hunter-gatherer?
Well, hunter-gatherers, as I said, don't have life review. Life review seems to be characteristic of people who have been shaped in some way or another with what the anthropologists called historical religions, so Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam. All of these are historical, recent religions. Most of them are only a few thousand years old. And what they do is that they put the emphasis on salvation, redemption, on the individual person. So there's a tremendous amount of emphasis, psychologically speaking, on individuals doing good, individual acts and individual attitudes. In the hunter-gatherer society, the individual is subservient to groupthink. So it is your community, the group, the small group of 30 or 40 people where you travel with them on all the different seasons. And your identity is also part of your totem. So if your totem is a goanna, a big lizard, then all the lizards and all the lizards' behaviour is your behaviour. So if you ask yourself, well, the lizards, they're, you know, like to eat lots of ants. You like to eat lots of ants. That's part of your identity. You share an identity with lizards. So a life review of your individual life doesn't make any sense in the psychology of hunter-gatherer society. Tunnel sensation, the same.
Both cultures have the vision of the white light in the tunnel?
Both societies have an encounter with a supernatural being. It's not always a bright white light. But in hunter-gatherer societies, they don't go down a dark tunnel. It's got to be said that the prevalence of tunnel sensation in near-death experiences in the West is low anyway. I think it's around 10 to 15% of the reports of near-death experiences have someone describing that they went down a dark tunnel. But what happens in hunter-gatherer societies is, if you look at the reported near-death experiences from those societies, gathered by missionaries, gathered by early researchers, gathered by explorers, and there's quite a lot of them, there's hundreds of these now, what you find is a storytelling that says, well, I was very sick, and then I went to sleep, and then I suddenly found myself rowing in a boat, and it was nighttime, and I rowed and I rowed until it became light. Or they say, I found myself suddenly walking in the forest, and I was walking along this dark path through the trees, and it suddenly got gradually light at the end, and I walked towards that light. Now, what this tells you is that there's clearly some experience of darkness in through to light, and that what happens is that in societies where tunnel is a word that means travelling through a dark area and to the light, people choose the word tunnel. In hunter-gatherer societies where they often don't have tunnels, but they know what night time is, they know what tree canopies are, they know what rowing in a river is, they'll use that language. So it's important to say that no experience can be understood separate from the language used to describe it. Mm-hmm. That's the key here. So clearly there's this issue about tunnel is a culture-specific description, not necessarily a reality. I don't think there is a tunnel, but clearly people are experiencing transit through darkness into light. And many people in the West describe that as a tunnel.
So how do you explain this? I mean, you as a sociologist, a scholar, can you explain it?
Explain what in particular?
These near-death experiences, why people have these experiences. I mean, is it contact with the other side, with another dimension?
I don't think I can answer that question. I'm not sure what it is. I can tell you that the hallucination experience is a bad one. It's got lots of holes in it. I can certainly tell you that. There's no doubt that there should be some physiological correlates for what's going on. You know, when you're happy, you smile at me. This is not just a spiritual experience. It's a physical experience. I'm expecting that there must be a whole set of neurons firing to make you, your mouth make a smile or even make you laugh, right?
Right.
No, there's nothing controversial about that. So if there are people who are having these mystical experiences, I'm expecting that there are some physiological correlates that can that are associated with this experience. However, don't expect me to believe that you can explain this whole experience through physiology any more than the physiology of smile can explain love. That's not going to work very well. If you think that you can get the neuronal pathways for smiling and generalize from that to talk about love between one human being and another, I think that's an unrealistic and arrogant way to think about scientific research.
So you're saying science will never be able to explain these kinds of mystical experiences, particularly these near-death experiences.
No, I don't. I wouldn't say that. I will say that medical research, again, I don't like the idea of science, but the medical researchers who are pushing hard at this, the psychophysiologists who are pushing hard at this kind of stuff, the brain people, are working hard to see what the pathways are, what are the correlates, if you like. And there's a difference between correlation and causation. And I think once you start saying these experiences are caused by this physiology, that's like saying happiness is caused by that physiology. That's not true. Otherwise, we'd be automatons. But I think that when medical research teams up with other disciplines from religious studies and from the social sciences and the humanities, we may end up with a more complex picture in the next 30 to 50 years, maybe, that suggests that our understanding of reality is perhaps more complex and ambiguous than we thought in 2014. I think that's possible.
Yeah. I have to ask, are you a religious person yourself?
I am not.
Would you describe yourself as having some sort of spiritual orientation?
I'm not really sure what you mean by that. I'm a maybe person. You know, the world is populated by people who say yes and no. And I'm an advocate for the maybes, or it's possible. I don't think I know it all. And I think one of the interesting things about every damn good scholar you meet, whether they're a physicist or whether they're a medical specialist of some sort, the best palliative care people I've worked with, the palliative care physicians, are people who are open on this. They don't think they know it all. There is a lot to learn. I think you need to be very careful not to rush to close things up. You know, this idea that we can explain a mystical experience at the end of life as a hallucination is an arrogance. The research evidence doesn't support that. It really doesn't. What it supports is a theory that these might be hallucinations. But there are competing theories just as good. And there are, for every suggestion, there is a reply. For every criticism, there's a reply. This is an ongoing debate at the moment. This is not like research on an ingrown toenail. This is very different, a different order of research we're talking about here. Fundamentally, at the basis of this type of research into mystical experiences is the question of what we are as human beings. Nothing short of that question is what we're dealing with here. So anybody who thinks they've got the answer to that by 5 o'clock this afternoon is trying to sell you something.
Okay.
It's that simple, mate.
let me rephrase the question with perhaps a more pointed way of asking it. Do you personally, given all that you've seen, all the people you've talked to, all these stories that you've heard, do you think consciousness can survive the physical death of the brain?
It may well do. That's my answer.
But, okay, let me press you on this. I mean, you've just told me these remarkable stories, these cross-cultural stories of these, you know, these mystical experiences. Why wouldn't you believe that, given all that you've heard?
Well, because I also listen to my colleagues, my materialist colleagues, who put up the objections, who trace the physiology of things, who make the bid, the hypothesis, the argument, that these are possibly subsets of hallucinations. They cannot be dismissed. So there is a balancing act in all good research. There's a balancing act. You need to look at the arguments for and the arguments against. I happen to think that there is sufficient evidence when looked when you look at all the research as a whole, and I have looked at all the research as a whole, when you look at the research as a whole, there is evidence to suggest these are more than hallucinations. They may be a special type of hallucination, maybe, or they may be a window to the afterlife. But I can tell you that the evidence at this stage does not answer it for us. So what this gives me is a couple of things which are not very valued these days. One is openness. Two is optimism.
Optimism that that we will come
that
to...
There may be, but there may, that we may be more than our flesh.
So you would like there to be more than the flesh?
Would I like there to be more? Yeah, I think I would. Yes, I don't think I'd like to go to the grave and rot. I'm quite prepared to do that if that's the way it is, if that's the way the universe works. But I just don't know enough to feel I could sell... I couldn't sell you personally on anything more than the idea that there is hope, that there is more than we can see and measure.
I mean, what I hear you saying is that you are fascinated by these mystical experiences we've been talking about. I mean, obviously, you've studied the literature. I'm guessing you've talked with people who've reported having them. But Your rational mind doesn't quite let you go there to fully embrace, I think, what we would consider sort of the fundamental conclusion for mystical experiences, that there's another dimension of reality out there.
Well, maybe you could say that. I don't think it's the rational mind that's holding me back. I have an obligation and responsibility in it to my training, which is to carefully sift the evidence, to carefully look fairly at the arguments. Right? That's an important part of what I do. But the second thing is that you can research things to the nth degree, but if you don't have your own personal experience, it's very, very hard to take that extra step. That extra step is what the Catholic Church used to call faith. And I don't have faith. If I had faith, maybe I'd be a religious person. I don't have that. I'm only left with hope.
Have you had any personal experiences that we would call mystical?
I don't think I've had anything mystical experiences. I think my life has been quite banal. All the thrills I've had have been as a researcher. And listening to people who have been able to share their experiences with me. And it's been really thrilling to... I mean, it is intriguing. It's intriguing. And it's an insult to be able to... I think, anyway, it's an insult to say, look, this person has brought me a message back from the afterlife. You know, if I was happy with that, I'd be a priest. Or this person has got a hallucination. If I want to dismiss everybody who had some unusual story with a psychiatric label, maybe I'd go into that line of work. But I'm not. I'm a sociologist. I'm a historical style of sociologist. I look at theory as well as empirical studies. I sift the stuff carefully. And all I can say to you is that the fair answer is still maybe. You can put it more strongly. Nothing to stop anybody, and thousands do. I mean, you could get... somebody from the American Skeptics who said, it's all garbage, Kelleher's talking nonsense, we know what causes this. I'd love to meet that person. Or you could get a New Age person who says, poor old Kelleher, he's strapped by being an academic. He's really got the straitjacket on. Well, I can tell you, not only is the near-death experience a window to the afterlife, but I can actually give you the street and the house number of where his dead relatives live. That's great. But actually, there's still a few of us in academia with responsibility that we take very seriously about stepping back and looking at all the arguments and all the data and trying to give a fair appraisal. And as I said, this is not research on ingrown toenails. There's nothing simple about this research. We're talking about a very serious question here that used to be at the heart of religion and is now at the heart of medical science as well. So we need to be careful.
Well, this is absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was great. That was fantastic. Thank you.
You like that?
Yeah, well, that was wonderful. Yeah.
I get pushed on this all the time, you know, Steve.
Sure.
And I really have to hold the line. I mean, I just, if I'd had a near-death experience, and there are plenty of near-death researchers who've had, they can come here enthusiastically and sell you the afterlife. I'd love to do that. I can't do that. I haven't, and I won't.